Chapter 25. The General Law of Capitalist Accumulation. Section 1. The increased demand for labour power that accompanies accumulation. The composition of capital remaining the same. In this chapter we consider the influence of the growth of capital on the lot of the labouring class. The most important factor in this inquiry is the composition of capital, and the changes it undergoes in the course of the process of accumulation. The composition of capital is to be understood in a twofold sense. On the side of value, it is determined by the proportion in which it is divided into constant capital, or value of the means of production, and variable capital, or value of labour power, the sum total of wages. On the side of material, as it functions in the process of production, all capital is divided into means of production and living labour power. This latter composition is determined by the relation between the mass of the means of production employed on the one hand, and the mass of labour necessary for their employment on the other. I call the former the value composition, the latter the technical composition of capital. Between the two there is a strict correlation. To express this, I call the value composition of capital, in so far as it is determined by its technical composition and mirrors the changes of the latter, the organic composition of capital. Wherever I refer to the composition of capital without further qualification, its organic composition is always understood. The many individual capitals invested in a particular branch of production have, one with another, more or less different compositions. The average of their individual compositions gives us the composition of the total capital in this branch of production. Lastly, the average of these averages, in all branches of production, gives us the composition of the total social capital of a country. And with this alone are we, in the last resort, concerned in the following investigation. Growth of capital involves growth of its variable constituent, or of the part invested in labour power. A part of the surplus value turned into additional capital must always be retransformed into variable capital, or additional labour fund. If we suppose that, all other circumstances remaining the same, the composition of capital also remains constant, that is, that a definite mass of means of production constantly needs the same mass of labour power to set it in motion, then the demand for labour and the subsistence fund of the labourers clearly increase in the same proportion as the capital, and the more rapidly the capital increases. Since the capital produces yearly a surplus value, of which one part is yearly added to the original capital, since this increment itself grows yearly along with the augmentation of the capital already functioning, since, lastly, under special stimulus to enrichment, such as the opening of new markets or of new spheres for the outlay of capital in consequence of newly developed social wants, etc., the scale of accumulation may be suddenly extended, merely by a change in the division of the surplus value or surplus product into capital and revenue. The requirements of accumulating capital may exceed the increase of labour power, or of the number of labourers. The demand for labourers may exceed the supply, and therefore wages may rise. This must, indeed, ultimately be the case if the conditions supposed continue. For since in each year more labourers are employed than in its predecessor, sooner or later a point must be reached at which the requirements of accumulation begin to surpass the customary supply of labour, and, therefore, a rise of wages takes place. A lamentation on this score was heard in England during the whole of the 15th and the first half of the 18th centuries. The more or less favourable circumstances in which the wage working class supports and multiplies itself, in no way alter the fundamental character of capitalist production. As simple reproduction constantly reproduces the capital relation itself, that is, the relation of capitalists on the one hand and wage workers on the other, so reproduction on a progressive scale, that is, accumulation, reproduces the capital relation on a progressive scale. More capitalists or larger capitalists at this pole, more wage workers at that. The reproduction of a mass of labour power, which must incessantly reincorporate itself with capital for that capital's self-expansion, which cannot get free from capital, and whose enslavement to capital is only concealed by the variety of individual capitalists to whom it sells itself, this reproduction of labour power forms, in fact, an essential of the reproduction of capital itself. Accumulation of capital is, therefore, increase of the proletariat. Footnote. Karl Marx. À égalité d'oppression des masses, plus un pays a de prolétaires, et plus il est riche. Collins. L'économie politique. Source de révolution et des utopies. Prétendu socialiste. Paris, 1857. Our proletarian is economically none other than the wage labourer, who produces and increases capital, and is thrown out on the streets as soon as he is superfluous for the needs of aggrandisement of Monsieur Capital, as Picœur calls this person. The sickly proletarian of the primitive forest is a pretty Rocherian fancy. The primitive forester is owner of the primitive forest, and uses the primitive forest as his property with the freedom of an orangutan. He is not, therefore, a proletarian. This would only be the case if the primitive forest exploited him instead of being exploited by him. As far as his health is concerned, such a man would well bear comparison not only with the modern proletarian, but also with the syphilitic and scrofulous upper classes. But no doubt Herr Wilhelm Roscher by primitive forest means his native heath of Lüneburg. End of footnote. Classical economy grasped this fact so thoroughly that Adam Smith, Ricardo, etc., as mentioned earlier, inaccurately identified accumulation with the consumption, by the productive labourers, of all the capitalised part of the surplus product, or with its transformation into additional wage labourers. As early as 1696, John Bellars says, "For if one had 100,000 acres of land, and as many pounds in money, and as many cattle, without a labourer, what would the rich man be but a labourer? And as the labourers make men rich, so the more labourers there will be, the more rich men, the labour of the poor being the mines of the rich." So also Bernard de Mandeville, at the beginning of the 18th century. "It would be easier, where property is well secured, to live without money than without poor. For who would do the work? As they, the poor, ought to be kept from starving, so they should receive nothing worth saving. If here and there one of the lowest class by uncommon industry and pinching his belly lifts himself above the condition he was brought up in, nobody ought to hinder him. Nay, it is undeniably the wisest course for every person in the society, and for every private family to be frugal, but it is the interest of all rich nations that the greatest part of the poor should almost never be idle, and yet continually spend what they get. Those that get their living by their daily labour have nothing to stir them up to be serviceable but their wants, which it is prudence to relieve, but folly to cure. The only thing, then, that can render the labouring man industrious is a moderate quantity of money, for as too little will, according as his temper is, either dispirit or make him desperate, So too much will make him insolent and lazy. From what has been said, it is manifest that in a free nation, where slaves are not allowed of, the surest wealth consists in a multitude of laborious poor, for besides that they are the never-failing nursery of fleets and armies, without them there could be no enjoyment, and no product of any country could be valuable. To make the society, which of course consists of non-workers, happy, and people easier under the meanest circumstances, it is requisite that great numbers of them should be ignorant as well as poor. Knowledge both enlarges and multiplies our desires, and the fewer things a man wishes for, the more easily his necessities may be supplied. Footnote. Bernard de Mondeville, The Fable of the Bees, 5th edition, London, 1728, remarks, "Temperate living and constant employment is the direct road for the poor to rational happiness," by which he most probably means long working days and little means of subsistence, "and to riches and strength for the state," viz., for the landlords, capitalists, and their political dignitaries and agents. An Essay on Trade and Commerce, London, 1770. What Mondeville, an honest, clear-headed man, had not yet seen, is that the mechanism of the process of accumulation itself increases, along with the capital, the mass of labouring poor, that is, the wage labourers, who turn their labour power into an increasing power of self-expansion of the growing capital, and even by doing so must eternize their dependent relation on their own product, as personified in the capitalists. In reference to this relation of dependence, Sir F. M. Eden, in his The State of the Poor, An History of the Labouring Classes in England, says, "The natural produce of our soil is certainly not fully adequate to our subsistence. We can neither be clothed, lodged, nor fed, but in consequence of some previous labour. A portion, at least, of the society must be indefatigably employed. There are others who, though they neither toil nor spin, can yet command the produce of industry, but who owe their exemption from labour solely to civilization and order. They are peculiarly the creatures of civil institutions, which have recognised that individuals may acquire property by various other means besides the exertion of labour. Persons of independent fortune owe their superior advantages by no means to any superior abilities of their own, but almost entirely to the industry of others. It is not the possession of land or of money, but the command of labour, which distinguishes the opulent from the labouring part of the community." This scheme, approved by Eden, would give the people of property sufficient, but by no means too much, influence and authority over those who work for them, and it would place such labourers not in an abject or servile condition, but in such a state of easy and liberal dependence as all who know human nature and its history will allow to be necessary for their own comfort. Footnote. Eden should have asked, "Whose creatures, then, are the civil institutions?" From his standpoint of juridical illusion, he does not regard the law as a product of the material relations of production, but conversely, the relations of production as products of the law. Languet overthrew Montesquieu's illusory esprit des lois with one word. The spirit of laws is property. End of footnote. Sir F. M. Eden, it may be remarked in passing, is the only disciple of Adam Smith during the 18th century that produced any work of importance. Footnote. If the reader reminds me of Malthus, whose essay on population appeared in 1798, I remind him that this work in its first form is nothing more than a schoolboyish, superficial plagiary of Defoe, Sir James Stuart, Townsend, Franklin, Wallace, etc., and does not contain a single sentence thought out by himself. The great sensation this pamphlet caused was due solely to party interest. The French Revolution had found passionate defenders in the United Kingdom. The principle of population, slowly worked out in the 18th century, and then in the midst of a great social crisis, proclaimed with drums and trumpets as the infallible antidote to the teachings of Condorcet, etc., was greeted with jubilance by the English oligarchy as the great destroyer of all hankerings after human development. Malthus, hugely astonished at his success, gave himself to stuffing into his book materials superficially compiled, and adding to it new matter, not discovered, but annexed by him. Note further, although Malthus was a parson of the English state church, he had taken the monastic vow of celibacy, one of the conditions of holding a fellowship in Protestant Cambridge University. Socios collegiorum maritos esse non permittimus, sed statim postquam, quis uxorum duxerit, socius collegii desinat esse. Reports of Cambridge University Commission. This circumstance favourably distinguishes Malthus from the other Protestant parsons, who have shuffled off the command enjoining a celibacy of the priesthood, and have taken "be fruitful and multiply" as their special biblical mission in such a degree that they generally contribute to the increase of population to a really unbecoming extent, whilst they preach at the same time to the labourers the principle of population. It is characteristic that the economic fall of man, the Adam's apple, the urgent appetite, the checks which tend to blunt the shafts of Cupid, as Parson Townsend waggishly puts it, that this delicate question was and is monopolised by the reverends of Protestant theology, or rather of the Protestant Church. With the exception of the Venetian monk Ortes, an original and clever writer, most of the population theory teachers are Protestant parsons. For instance, Bruckner, Théorie du système animal, Leyde, 1767, in which the whole subject of the modern population theory is exhausted, and to which the passing quarrel between Quesnay and his pupil, the elder Mirabeau, furnished ideas on the same topic. Then Parson Wallace, Parson Townsend, Parson Malthus, and his pupil, the Archparson Thomas Chalmers, to say nothing of lesser reverend scribblers in this line. Originally, political economy was studied by philosophers like Hobbes, Locke, Hume, by businessmen and statesmen like Thomas More, Temple, Sully, DeWitt, North, Law, Vanderlint, Cantillon, Franklin, and especially, and with the greatest success, by medical men like Petty, Barbon, Mandeville, Quesnay. Even in the middle of the 18th century, the Reverend Mr. Tucker, a notable economist of his time, excused himself for meddling with the things of mammon. Later on, and in truth with this very principle of population, struck the hour of the Protestant parsons. Petty, who regarded the population as the basis of wealth, and was, like Adam Smith, an outspoken foe to parsons, says, as if he had a presentiment of their bungling interference, that religion best flourishes when the priests are most mortified, as was before said of the law, which best flourisheth when lawyers have least to do. He advises the Protestant priests, therefore, if they, once for all, will not follow the Apostle Paul and mortify themselves by celibacy, not to breed more churchmen than the benefices, as they now stand shared out, will receive. That is to say, if there be places for about 12,000 in England and Wales, it will not be safe to breed up 24,000 ministers, for then the 12,000 which are unprovided for will seek ways how to get themselves a livelihood, which they cannot do more easily than by persuading the people that the 12,000 incumbents do poison or starve their souls and misguide them in their way to heaven. Petty, A Treatise of Taxes and Contributions, London, 1667. Adam Smith's position with the Protestant priesthood of his time is shown by the following. In A Letter to A. Smith, LLD, on the Life, Death, and Philosophy of his Friend David Hume, by One of the People Called Christians, 4th edition, Oxford, 1784. Dr. Horne, Bishop of Norwich, reproves Adam Smith, because in a published letter to Mr. Strawn, he embalmed his friend David Hume because he told the world how Hume amused himself on his deathbed with Lucian and Whist, and because he even had the impudence to write of Hume, "I have always considered him, both in his lifetime and since his death, as approaching as nearly to the idea of a perfectly wise and virtuous man as, perhaps, the nature of human frailty will permit." The bishop cries out, in a passion, "Is it right in you, sir, to hold up to our view as perfectly wise and virtuous the character and conduct of one who seems to have been possessed with an incurable antipathy to all that is called religion, and who strained every nerve to explode, suppress, and extirpate the spirit of it among men, that its very name, if he could effect it, might no more be had in remembrance? But let not the lovers of truth be discouraged. Atheism cannot be of long continuance." Adam Smith had the atrocious wickedness to propagate atheism through the land, viz. By his theory of moral sentiments. "Upon the whole, Doctor, your meaning is good, but I think that you will not succeed this time. You would persuade us, by the example of David Hume, Esquire, that atheism is the only cordial for low spirits, and the proper antidote against the fear of death. You may smile over Babylon in ruins, and congratulate the hardened Pharaoh on his overthrow in the Red Sea." One orthodox individual, amongst Adam Smith's college friends, writes after his death, "Smith's well-placed affection for Hume hindered him from being a Christian. When he met with honest men whom he liked, he would believe almost anything they said. Had he been a friend of the worthy, ingenious Horrocks, he would have believed that the moon sometimes disappeared in a clear sky without the interposition of a cloud. He approached to republicanism in his political principles." The Bee, by James Anderson, Edinburgh, 1791-93. Parson Thomas Chalmers has his suspicions as to Adam Smith having invented the category of unproductive labourers solely for the Protestant parsons, in spite of their blessed work in the vineyard of the Lord. End of footnote. Under the conditions of accumulation supposed thus far, which conditions are those most favourable to the labourers, their relation of dependence upon capital takes on a form endurable, or, as Eden says, easy and liberal. Instead of becoming more intensive with the growth of capital, this relation of dependence only becomes more extensive, that is, the sphere of capital's exploitation and rule merely extends with its own dimensions and the number of its subjects. A larger part of their own surplus product, always increasing and continually transformed into additional capital, comes back to them in the shape of means of payment, so that they can extend the circle of their enjoyments, can make some additions to their consumption fund of clothes, furniture, etc., and can lay by small reserve funds of money. But just as little as better clothing, food, and treatment, and a larger peculium do away with the exploitation of the slave, so little do they set aside that of the wage worker. A rise in the price of labour, as a consequence of accumulation of capital, only means, in fact, that the length and weight of the golden chain the wage worker has already forged for himself allow of a relaxation of the tension of it. In the controversies on this subject, the chief fact has generally been overlooked, viz., the defining characteristic of capitalistic production. Labour power is sold today not with a view of satisfying by its service or by its product the personal needs of the buyer. His aim is augmentation of his capital, production of commodities containing more labour than he pays for, containing, therefore, a portion of value that costs him nothing, and that is nevertheless realised when the commodities are sold. Production of surplus value is the absolute law of this mode of production. Labour power is only saleable so far as it preserves the means of production in their capacity of capital, reproduces its own value as capital, and yields in unpaid labour a source of additional capital. Footnote. The limit, however, to the employment of both the operative and the labourer is the same, namely the possibility of the employer realising a profit on the produce of their industry. If the rate of wages is such as to reduce the master's gains below the average profit of capital, he will cease to employ them, or he will only employ them on condition of submission to a reduction of wages. John Wade. End of footnote. The conditions of its sale, whether more or less favourable to the labourer, include therefore the necessity of its constant reselling, and the constantly extended reproduction of all wealth in the shape of capital. Wages, as we have seen, by their very nature, always imply the performance of a certain quantity of unpaid labour on the part of the labourer. Altogether, irrespective of the case of a rise of wages with a falling price of labour, etc., such an increase only means, at best, a quantitative diminution of the unpaid labour that the worker has to supply. This diminution can never reach a point at which it would threaten the system itself. Apart from violent conflicts as to the rate of wages, and Adam Smith has already shown that in such a conflict, taken on the whole, the master is always the master, a rise in the price of labour resulting from accumulation of capital implies the following alternative. Either the price of labour keeps on rising because its rise does not interfere with the progress of accumulation. In this there is nothing wonderful, for, says Adam Smith, after these profits are diminished, stock may not only continue to increase, but to increase much faster than before. A great stock, though with small profits, generally increases faster than a small stock with great profits. In this case, it is evident that a diminution in the unpaid labour in no way interferes with the extension of the domain of capital. Or, on the other hand, accumulation slackens in consequence of the rise in the price of labour, because the stimulus of gain is blunted. The rate of accumulation lessens, but with its lessening, the primary cause of that lessening vanishes, that is, the disproportion between capital and exploitable labour power. The mechanism of the process of capitalist production removes the very obstacles that it temporarily creates. The price of labour falls again to a level corresponding with the needs of the self-expansion of capital, whether the level be below, the same as, or above, the one which was normal before the rise of wages took place. We see thus. In the first case, it is not the diminished rate, either of the absolute or of the proportional increase in labour power or labouring population, which causes capital to be in excess, but conversely, the excess of capital that makes exploitable labour power insufficient. In the second case, it is not the increased rate, either of the absolute or of the proportional increase in labour power, or labouring population, that makes capital insufficient, but conversely, the relative diminution of capital that causes the exploitable labour power, or rather its price, to be in excess. It is these absolute movements of the accumulation of capital which are reflected as relative movements of the mass of exploitable labour power, and therefore seem produced by the latter's own independent movement. To put it mathematically, The rate of accumulation is the independent, not the dependent, variable. The rate of wages, the dependent, not the independent, variable. Thus, when the industrial cycle is in the phase of crisis, a general fall in the price of commodities is expressed as a rise in the value of money, and in the phase of prosperity, a general rise in the price of commodities as a fall in the value of money. The so-called currency school concludes from this that with high prices too much, with low prices too little money is in circulation. Their ignorance and complete misunderstanding of facts, footnote, cf. Karl Marx, Zur Kritik der politischen Ökonomie, end of footnote, are worthily paralleled by the economists, who interpret the above phenomena of accumulation by saying that there are now too few, now too many, wage labourers. The law of capitalist production, that is at the bottom of the pretended natural law of population, reduces itself simply to this. The correlation between accumulation of capital and rate of wages is nothing else than the correlation between the unpaid labour transformed into capital and the additional paid labour necessary for the setting in motion of this additional capital. It is therefore in no way a relation between two magnitudes independent one of the other. On the one hand, the magnitude of the capital, on the other, the number of the labouring population. It is, rather, at bottom, only the relation between the unpaid and the paid labour of the same labouring population. If the quantity of unpaid labour supplied by the working class and accumulated by the capitalist class increases so rapidly that its conversion into capital requires an extraordinary addition of paid labour, then wages rise, and, all other circumstances remaining equal, the unpaid labour diminishes in proportion. But as soon as this diminution touches the point at which the surplus labour that nourishes capital is no longer supplied in normal quantity, a reaction sets in. A smaller part of revenue is capitalised, accumulation lags, and the movement of rising wages receives a check. The rise of wages, therefore, is confined within limits that not only leave intact the foundations of the capitalistic system, but also secure its reproduction on a progressive scale. The law of capitalistic accumulation, metamorphosed by economists into pretended law of nature, in reality merely states that the very nature of accumulation excludes every diminution in the degree of exploitation of labour, and every rise in the price of labour, which could seriously imperil the continual reproduction on an ever-enlarging scale of the capitalistic relation. It cannot be otherwise in a mode of production in which the labourer exists to satisfy the needs of self-expansion of existing values, instead of, on the contrary, material wealth existing to satisfy the needs of development on the part of the labourer. As, in religion, man is governed by the products of his own brain, so, in capitalistic production, he is governed by the products of his own hand. Footnote. If we now return to our first inquiry, wherein it was shown that capital itself is only the result of human labour, it seems quite incomprehensible that man can have fallen under the domination of capital, his own product, can be subordinated to it, and as in reality this is beyond dispute the case, involuntarily the question arises, how has the labourer been able to pass from being master of capital, as its creator, to being its slave? Von Thunen, Der isolierte Staat. It is Thunen's merit to have asked this question. His answer is simply childish. End of footnote.